Today my guest is Nina Lauck, CEO of Glycan Age, a company that calculates your biological age. In this episode, we delve into the science of age reversal.
This internal decline that happens leads to disease. And if you tackle this early, instead of waiting for an issue, then you're actually doing preventive healthcare.
How menopause affects biological age.
So HRT works really well. We did a nice placebo-controlled trial, and we would see about 9 years aging in menopause. So your biological age on average changes by 9 years. And actually, the ones who are the youngest pre-menopause usually have the steepest slope of aging as they go through menopause.
What lifestyle changes can help reduce your age?
And if they gain weight, they are aging faster. If they're losing weight, they're aging slower. And then we did that in caloric restriction diet as well.
Nina, hello and welcome to my show. Thank you for agreeing to be a guest here today.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Well, Nina, I wanted to get you on when I heard you talk at the Health Optimization Summit a few weeks ago. I've always been fascinated with aging and trying to prevent or stop aging, defying what we consider old age and how we sort of reverse the clock. And I guess although we're not quite there yet, the science has come on so much that there's lots that can now be done about it. But before we get into your company, can you tell me a little bit about your background, what you do, and how you've got to where you've got to today?
Sure, no, absolutely. But just to add to your comment on aging, I think aging is great. I feel better every year. You get this experience and confidence in life. I definitely want to age, but I don't want to age biologically, which is a different thing. And I think that's what you're talking about. So my background is not actually science, it's tech. But I come from a family of scientists. So both my mother and father are scientists. My mother's a neuroscientist and my father's a glycobiologist. So this company actually came from his work. So the background story on this is not actually mine, it's his. But I came into it, actually, I guess we came full circle in. But when he was 20, my dad, he joined the glycobiology lab, which we'll talk about later. And he met my mother and they worked on a paper together on brain aging. So glycans and brain aging. And this was 1991. And then they had me as one of the consequences of this. So I guess we came full circle into that. So my background is tech. I did tech for almost 12 years, actually. So I started quite young. With startups. So I had about 5 companies, 3 of which were successful businesses. And then over the last 10 years, because this field of aging clocks is about 10 years old. So even our aging clock was published about 10 years ago. He was convincing me throughout the time, saying, this can be something, this is a, interesting thing we stumble on in research, we can measure aging of people, like internal aging of people. This can eventually turn into a product. But I think when he was pitching it to me, first time I was 20. So, I didn't care about age. If anything, I always, I would say, try and hide my age or say that 25. So I was like, I do not want to know.
You always want to look older the younger you are. And then when you get older, you want to look young. It's just, it's one of those things.
Yeah, it always works like that. But I think when I started to understand it from a preventative healthcare perspective. So, this internal decline that happens leads to disease. And if you tackle this early, instead of waiting for an issue, then you're actually doing preventive healthcare. And then, I got passionate about it. And we started it off commercially in 2020 after a few decades of research. And I was our first investor. So that's how I got into it.
Wow. So you hung up, I guess, your entrepreneur's hat. Well, no, you're still a huge entrepreneur, but hung up your own things to concentrate on the family business.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, you know, we spoke about your background before we got going. I got to a stage where I had a very successful business. I was making more money than ever in life, and I was incredibly bored with what I was doing. I was not fulfilled. It just didn't hit the right spots. And with this, I make a lot less than I used to, and I don't care about it. Honestly, I say I love the fact that I could stop working for money, or the money doesn't matter anymore. So,
and I think that's, if you can get to that point and look, especially with the work you're doing now, Nina, which is incredible. You're really changing people's lives, and you know, you're a hallmark for the future. But let's get into this. Let's talk about Glycan Age. Can you give me a little bit of an overview of Glycan Age? And we're going to have to ask the question what glycans actually are.
And that's the most difficult one, because glycans haven't been publicly spoken about a lot, or they have not been popularized. Genetics have been popularized. Microbiome has been popularized. But the glycobiology has stayed on this kind of fringe science, because you don't have many scientists working on it. You have a couple hundred scientists in the world working on it, while you have, you know, 100,000 neuroscientists and so forth. But what glycans are, if you look at cell biology, so we look at the cell, it has four components. One is DNA, then protein, then lipid or fat, and carb. And glycans are the carbs, or the sugar part. But a lot of times when we say sugar, people think about dietary sugar. They think about how the sugar you're eating impacts your biology, or things that lead to diabetes, damage of sugars to your proteins that leads to diabetes. But actually, there's a different sugar process, a sugar language that we created. So this is sugars you manufacture within your cell that become a component of your lipids, your proteins, all of your biology, that are there to enable your biology to communicate. There will be these types of therapies in the future where you can manipulate them with a drug or a dietary, but they're not sugars that are, you manufacture them, you create them. They're not sugars that are impacted directly by your diet. So it's more of sugars that have evolved for you to change beyond genetics. And for your, you can think of it, you know, they're this thing that helps everything communicate. So you do, if you think of multicellular life, we would not have multicellular life or complex organisms without cell-to-cell communication. And that's what these sugars enable. With aging, what we specialize, or what the lab specialized in originally, are antibodies. Because of this, the whole space of monoclonal antibodies became a very popular therapy or drug. And it was understood exactly what do these sugars on antibodies do. But nobody was quantifying them at scale. Nobody was looking at thousands of people to understand at scale what the sugars are doing. So back in 2006, 2007, our lab ran a study for the first large analysis of this part of biology. So the first 1,000 human glycans were analyzed then with our lab, which is in Croatia, and another lab in Dublin, which pioneered this space to look at this part of biology at scale. And then as this got into a couple hundred thousand people, what they realize is if they're looking at the disease, they can't make sense of it unless they know age of a patient, because the age of the patient has a stronger impact than the disease. Or you can have a young person who has a chronic condition who has a profile of a healthy old person. And what they were specifically looking at, and you know, you can look at many different, you know, you can look at glycans on, you know, many different proteins and lipids and cells. They were looking at them on antibodies or the adaptive immune system, specifically immunoglobulins. And the adaptive immune system is your immune system throughout life. So everything that's impacted it, how it's changed throughout life, you know, with impact of your genetics, with impact of your environment, your epigenetics, and your lifestyle. And what they saw is that as the immune system ages, it loses or it changes functionality in a way that it overreacts to the wrong things, creating chronic inflammation. So what we actually see with aging, we see this accumulation of chronic inflammation throughout life, or something called inflammation, that later on turns into disease. But we also look at the other side of it, which is anti-inflammatory, which loses this function with time. Because when we're young, we're really resilient. You react to a threat and you shut down inflammation straight away, but you react as your body should. But then as you get older, you stop reacting, and that's when you get cancer, or you overreact to something you shouldn't, like a pathogen.
So I think there's quite an important point, I think, that you've just made, or it's the actual correlation between aging and the disease itself. So we can't stop growing old, we can't stop our chronological age, but we automatically assume as we get older, we're going to get diseases. That's sort of the assumption, I think. So is sort of what you're saying here is we can actually do something about the disease part. So aging doesn't actually mean or need to mean that we get disease.
Absolutely. And the most of the things that we die from today are chronic diseases or diseases of aging. And that's a process that doesn't happen overnight. But right now, how healthcare works, you're healthy, and then as if overnight something happened and you have a disease. And that's when you usually identify that there's a problem. But on this molecular level, this has been happening for decades, and you have been heading there for decades. It's just nobody could give you this warning that you are going to bump into a disease. But at a time you can do something about it. Because right now, when you detect it, it's already at the stage where you're going to go on a therapy for the rest of your life. Very little of it is actually curable. Well, if it's an early warning and you can preempt it, then you have time to do prevention and delay that and prolong the years that you have of health life.
So how does your company sort of identify this, the aging process from the glycans?
We look at aging, glycan age as it is now, looks at immune aging, or how is your adaptive immune system, your immune system that changes and influences everything, age throughout time. But we can also look at it scientifically from metabolic. So currently we would call this inflammation or immune aging, but also scientifically we can look at metabolic aging or metaflammation. But all of it goes back to chronic inflammation.
Wow.
That's the basis.
There are many different, as I understand it, different biomarkers as well. What makes the glycans more important, or in your opinion, than say other biomarkers? I mean, I've heard a lot of, certainly a few years ago, everyone was talking about telomeres.
So you had a few theories of what is aging, and we still don't have consensus in the field, and it's probably not going to be one thing. There's aging is a complex system. So it's, we will never eventually, we'll never, it will never be one thing that determines everything. It will be factors which are impacting multiple things, like with chronic inflammation, we know it's a factor in majority of the diseases you develop, and aging itself. But that will not mean every single disease. So the first theory of how we can measure aging were telomeres. And this was 20, 25 years ago now. And with time, this was disproven as a relevant way of measuring aging, because telomeres are more relevant to aging of a single cell. So like these, at the tips of your DNA, telomeres shorten, and then eventually, this is why cells die. But cells are supposed to die. So, and you have trillions of cells. So if you collect a bunch of cells and then you measure their age, each of them is going to have a completely different age. And then if you model that into a clock, it's not going to be a very stable clock, because you can collect one sample, two samples at the same time, run an algorithm and get a 10, 20 years different just based on how you collected the sample. And it's not as relevant to systemic aging. It's more relevant to single cell aging, which showed not to have as much importance for health outcomes as some other things. So telomeres were the first fear of how we can measure aging, and then we realized that, you know, it's not that simple, and nothing's really simple in biology. Then 10 years ago, we've had the first glycan and epigenetic aging clock. So by coincidence, our clock and Steve Horvitz's epigenetic clock were published on the 10th of December 2013, both at the same time. Steve was a single author, and you know, he published a full paper at once. We published a preprint together with 30 plus different scientists. So it was a collaborative effort. And these are the first, let's say, new aging clocks or functional aging clocks, which are now opening up this space of being able to measure aging. So we are one of the oldest clocks. But because epigenetics have been developed more, and the genomics field kind of drove all of this development, which now led to epigenetics, which is, you know, how you're turning on genes on and off throughout life. Everybody's focused on epigenetics. But what's going to happen, we're going to get to a certain point, and then realize we miss half of the picture in our biology, which is complexly post-translational modifications, which are glycans, which is something that changes your biology beyond genetics and epigenetics. So I'll try to simplify this, but your DNA codes for a protein. And protein is the workhorse in the body. It does most of the work. And you can change how this protein is made for epigenetics. So this is the first level of what leads to the development of a protein. But then as this protein is made, it's made together with glycans. And then the glycans change this protein beyond its genetics and epigenetics. So they're more current, they're more holistic, they take more things into account. And when you're looking at it, you're looking at something that, you know, has all of these different layers which make you unique as an individual. So
I guess the question would be, is can we change it?
Yes, and that was first. So when the clock was published, the biggest question was, okay, now we can measure biological aging, but what's the point of measuring it if we can't do anything to change it? It would just be bad news. So from that point, so that was about 3-4 years later, but the lab mainly focused on intervention studies. So what type of lifestyle changes or therapies are going to change the clock? And now we have many. We've published over 20 intervention studies on how you can change your glycans and your aging clock. So there's many ways you can change it.
And I'd love just to talk about a few, but perhaps before we get there, it would be interesting just to talk about the actual test itself. I've actually recently done the test. I'm very excited about it because I've always been very much into my health, fitness, looking good. I've had so many people say, hey, you don't look your age. And then more recently, I've heard, oh, well, if you don't look it on the outside, maybe you don't look, maybe you're not as old on the inside. And because I do dedicate a lot of my life to my fitness and to my health, to what I eat, to lifestyle, to mindset, I became incredibly curious to find out what my biological age, let's just define that's not chronological age, which is my actual age, which is 52, but my actual your internal clock. Am I right in that sort of definition, Nina?
Good definition.
Great. So the test I took was really, really simple. I took at the Health Optimization Summit, and it was just a very, very simple blood test. And then, as I understand, it gets sent off to your labs where it's tested. And perhaps you could tell me, Nina, what they're testing for or how they then work out from that little bit of blood my biological age and the markers and areas that I could change, because we can go on and talk about the results. And what I'd like to do in 6 months' time when I review it is see if I've managed to bring my age down.
So if you can think of it as a general metric, a metric for your general health, which, you know, then you're speeding in life or you're going slower. And interestingly, it's not visual. It can be very different to visual, which was surprising to us as well. But we had one study that was looking at skin and internal biomarkers. And for example, people who spend a lot of time on the sun looked older, but actually had sometimes some better internal markers. So it's not, skin is a little bit different, and especially something like inflammation. It's sometimes visible, but on a very low level, the level where we love that, we call it sterile systemic inflammation, something that's really, how would you call it? Like very, but very low level, you don't really see it. And that's why, you know, you can have people who look perfectly fit and look very healthy, but they have an underlying chronic condition, which is, you know, which is making their life far more difficult. So I've lost your question there, but I think you were, what happens in the lab? Okay, yes. So you take these 4 drops of blood, and you take 4 because we run the analysis multiple times. So we validate that we run it in triplicates. So when we give you a number, that number has an error margin, which is less than a year. So if you test the next time and you see a year change, that's a significant, like that's a relevant change, because we make sure that the number we give you is very accurate. What we actually measure, we pull out your antibodies, your immunoglobulins, and then we cut the glycans around these immunoglobulins, and then we quantify them. And you have about 31 different glycan structure on your antibodies. And certain ones are pro-inflammatory ones, but other ones are anti-inflammatory. So we look at how many of each do you have, and if you, you know, it's the right balance of them. So you're supposed to have both, but it should be the right balance. And then we compare that to a large population set. And our population set is over 200,000 people from different biobanks around the world. We have very good gender proportions. Actually, we're more female baseline than male. I think it's about 60% female and 40% male. And we have very good, we have about 31 different ethnicities in there as well. So we then give you this number based on where you should be closest, you know, compared to your gender, your ethnicity, and your age. So we've always seen gender differences in aging. And what men would move very linearly. Like they just go up in a straight line. They lose the good stuff and accumulate the bad stuff. Women, they seem to have this type of U-curve, where in a way they're better, more favorable to men pre-menopause. And also women have less chronic disease pre-menopause. And then menopause is the main aging event in women. They catch up with men, and they even go a little bit over men and then move on the straight line, which makes sense because women have more chronic disease post-menopause. They do live longer, and they do go on the same line later on, but they do have more. This is the main health decline in women in general. And it's not as easy to manage because every woman is different. But actually where it starts is pregnancy. So the first time we see women have an accelerated aging clock by a natural event is pregnancy, post-pregnancy. So in pregnancy, they get younger. The body, in a way, protects the newborn, or you get healthier. Even some chronic conditions go into remission, like rheumatoid arthritis goes into remission.
Interesting.
Naturally. And then postpartum, they go the opposite direction, and they recover sometimes post breastfeeding. So in a way, you optimize everything for the baby, and then you sacrifice yourself for the new generation, and then you go back to your baseline. So it's a temporarily aging. You go back to where you were. Most women go to where they were. It's not permanently there. But then as the ovaries get to a stage that you don't need them anymore, nature becomes more cruel. And all of the systems suffer.
Everything.
Yes. And it can be, so when we noticed this initially, we thought it was just menopause. But then actually 3 years ago, when we had exposure to it, because in science, you just see dots. And you have some information on these dots, but you never meet the people. So you don't really know what's going on. And then as we met some of the people, we realized, you know, we would have a conversation about menopause because we see this acceleration. And then when we asked the person on the other side, are you in menopause, and they will say, no, I have a perfectly regular cycle. And we realized then that we see these changes even in perimenopause. And we went back to a study with twins in Queen's College, so Twins UK Biobank. And we asked them, you know, we analyzed the samples and got their menopause cycle data. And we saw that this change in the aging clock and our chronic inflammation happens years before you lose your cycle. And actually, menopause right now is detected only after it's at the end stage. So a year plus a day that you haven't had a cycle,
yes,
you're actually in menopause, but you can have all of these symptoms of menopause and all of the health decline up to a decade before then. And a lot of times you're misdiagnosed because the symptoms are so diverse and different woman to woman. And
what can you do about, so I'm on HRT, and as I understand it, estrogen has a lot to play with it. I'm actually on estrogen and testosterone and the progesterone, the whole lot. And I've got to say it has changed my life and it is fantastic, but that's a conversation for another episode. But yes, what is it in, or how can we help this process?
So HRT works really well. We did a nice placebo-controlled trial and we would see about 9 years aging in menopause. So your biological age on average changes by 9 years. But it varies woman to woman. It can be from 2 to 30. It's very individual. And actually the ones who are the youngest pre-menopause usually have the steepest slope of aging as they go through menopause. But HRT would also reverse it by these 7 to 9 years. It doesn't work for everyone. It's probably to do with types and dose, and it's an area we're actively investigating in. But estrogen on its own is a big component in aging, not just in women, but in men. Because we did the same type of trial in men with testosterone replacement, and testosterone converts to estrogen. And if you block conversion of testosterone to estrogen, they don't see beneficial. And there was even a study in mice where they gave male mice a non-feminizing estrogen called alpha 17 estradiol, and they live 20% longer from this non-feminizing estrogen, just the male mice. So it's also estrogen in men. Men should have, and the problem with menopause is that post-menopause, women have less estrogen than men. It floors. And then, of course, your whole body suffers, and you have estrogen receptors everywhere, from heart to brain to skin. So if you don't replace it, it is a huge impact on the body, and it's very difficult to navigate. But as you do replace it, there's not one size fits all. So a lot of it is based on your symptoms, and you're given you're given the standard dose, and then if you respond well, great, you continue. If not, you change the dose, maybe you add another hormone and you follow the symptoms. And of course, everything else in life has an impact. Your exercise, your diet, your lifestyle, all of this is making an impact. And we do see that as when you're going through menopause, a lot of times women try to do everything to mitigate the effects. And a lot of times that means going to the gym a lot. And if they have not done that before, it's a big shock to the body. And exercise is good at the right level, but a lot of times women are taught to train like men. And when women train like men, they lose their cycle because it's...
Because we're not men.
Stress in the body. And if you put stress in the body, you suppress your reproductive system, you suppress your immune system, you suppress your digestive system. So if you're putting chronic stress in yourself through exercise, you are artificially inducing menopause.
You know, exercise is, and for me, it's I live and breathe by exercise. It's the first thing that gets put in my diary, a session at the gym. I'm a bodybuilder, used to compete, and I still now, and I talk about this to women, how important it is to resistance train. The one thing I've sort of learned after 20 years of hitting heavy cardio and sweating sessions where I'm throwing up practically in a bucket, I've stopped that type of training because I realized that was just not doing my body any good. Yeah, I see a lot of men and women still do this type of training. And I particularly, I see women and I just think, you know, we're all taught this is how to lose weight. This is how you're going to get a better body, which I don't actually believe in anyway. But also that we're not actually told how bad it actually can be for you if you overdo it. Can you measure if someone's what the sort of sweet spot is between somebody overdoing it and taking the necessary breaks?
You can use glycans for that, or you can use our Asian clock. It's a very nice way to measure both positive and negative impacts of exercise. So we did studies where we had just sprint training, for example, and after 12 weeks, we would see just anti-inflammatory or anti-aging changes post-training. And in that study, they also measured acute inflammatory markers, and recovery post-exercise is inflammation. Because you're building new tissue, you're building new muscle, you need inflammation.
To build.
But it shouldn't be chronic. It should be there for the moment of recovery, and you're recovered and you're back to a healthy baseline and even go down a little bit under. So it's basically positive and negative stress. If you shock the system, the system is sleeping and it's kind of in a comfort zone, and you shock it and you get it to recycle, to build something new, to kind of clean up and, you know, kill old cells, build new cells, so forth. And then you have the opposite of that, which is loss of homeostasis. And that is more going towards chronic stress or chronic inflammation. So we did another study in bodybuilding. And interestingly, you had two cohorts in this study. You had one which was on a diet and exercise regime before bikini fitness competing, so what you did in the past. And you had one which was just on exercise. They were just exercising. There is no diet, dietary restriction. And what was interesting, we followed them for 3 months. We looked at gene expression. We looked at the entire immune system, aging, and everything changed for inflammatory and negatively in both cohorts. So both of them got older. Both of them changed negatively. It is huge stress in the body to prepare for bodybuilding. Very few athletes can perform at a high level without doing damage. What was interesting is in this cohort that just exercised, they recovered. After the 3 month period, they were back to their healthy baseline. There was no long-term consequence. The ones which were on the diet and exercise at the same time didn't recover in the 3 months we followed them. Now, we don't know if they recover a year or two later, but there was something there that when you put stress on top of stress, so you're depriving your body of nutrients and you're forcing it to build new muscle, it just, some damage stays, or maybe you create scar tissue in muscle that stays there. We don't fully understand what's going on yet, and there's very little science being done on this overtraining and negative consequences of exercise, but there's definitely a lot there to explore, where if you go to the extreme, you lose the health benefits. And there are long studies looking at bodybuilding with follow-up for outcomes, where they see the people who train, strength train, up to 90 minutes a week, have a reduction of all-cause mortality of 20%. So there is no debate about exercising being good for longevity or benefiting your long-term health. But what they also saw, that people who regularly train 3 hours of strength training per week actually increase their all-cause mortality. This is a study on the average person. There is no such thing as an average person. So any conclusion from these studies of, you know, do 10,000 steps a day, or, you know, do 150 minutes per week, they're all generic advice. And they actually never apply to you as an individual. And the only way we can measure what applies to us as individual is to have objective individual metrics. And you might be perfectly fine training 5 times a week. We have athletes who train 7 times a week, but they compensate with, you know, 12 hours sleeping 12 hours or having all kinds of recovery routines that actually offset all of this for them, and they are fully recovered. You might have a very good training range. You might have done this for such a long time that your body's adapted to it, and you can do it without having the consequences of it. But majority probably cannot. And it takes time to get to a level where you can train that much and not have consequences of that. And a lot of these consequences are not big. You don't feel them straight away. They're immune system. So we all know that if you overdo exercise, you will get a cold. You will suppress your immune system. You'll be more vulnerable to getting ill. Digestive system. That's another one, because if you are in chronic stress, you're not digesting. You cannot be running from a lion and digesting at the same time. And the problem is, if you're in that state chronically, you do have, these consequences accumulate as well. And then it's endocrine system, and a lot of even the bone density can be impacted negatively with overexercise. So it's a fine balance on an individual level, and I think it will be for you to see what it is for you, and potentially changing one of those hours to something which is more relaxing. So you can try yoga or aerial yoga, whatever it is. Try changing 1 hour with some. Try changing strength training, because strength training is always building new muscle, and depends on, of course, the intensity of it, and where your goal is.
I have been doing it for years, so I sort of now know where my body, where when I'm really tired, I try and stop, but it also is addictive, and there is a mindset thing in it, and I think that's one thing. I'm going to say a lot of women have this addiction of. Particularly, I guess, high achieving women that they just feel like they constantly need to pound out things. One of the things will be exercise. And it's interesting you say combined with diet, because most people do actually combine it with diet and usually eating very little. Now, I also intermittent fast. I don't know whether have the studies shown whether intermittent fasting is beneficial on the glycan age?
We have done a recent study on fasting, so a 7-day fast, just water fast. And this was only 7 days, and we measured before and after. So we didn't actually measure glycan age, the current version. We measured this metabolic age, which is the new clock that we're working on. And that changed positively. And the change that we saw means a reduction in hypertension and insulin resistance, future risk of hypertension and insulin resistance. So fasting has a lot of good sides. Now, this is an intense 1 week fast. Well, where data is missing, and there is some publication, and the problem with these big studies where you're looking at a lot of people and following up them long term, you don't know what cause and effect. So there was one study before about birth control, and women on birth control were more likely to develop skin cancer. And it ends up birth control had nothing to do with skin cancer. It's just for some reason, women on birth control also sunbathed more. So the cause and effect, it's hard to distinguish, but there have been a few studies, the big ones, just observational studies, looking at intermittent fasting. And there has been an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality and other things. So potentially, there is a limit to it. Of when it, where it's beneficial and where it's not so beneficial. And there's definitely individual limits to it. One of them is known, and that's the impact on your thyroid. So if you have an underactive thyroid or a slower metabolism, if you are also fasting, that will negatively reflect on your overall health. So I would say if somebody's intermittent fasting, I would say check your thyroid. If it's good, maybe you're not doing any damage and you have the benefits of it. But if you have an underactive thyroid and you're adding fasting on top, then that's probably not good. Also, if you're intensely exercising and then adding intermittent fasting, maybe those two things don't couple as well. But I can't tell you that we fully know the answer to that. But I think there's definitely more and more evidence coming out that this calories in, calories out theory was just too simple to be correct. We're not a machine. We don't just burn calories. It's how would I explain this simply? But you need to fuel new muscle. You cannot force yourself to build new muscle and then deprive yourself of nutrients. And that could be, for example, my result goes up if I don't eat properly. If I train and I eat properly, it stays in a good range. But if I don't eat properly and I train, then it goes the other way.
That it's honestly, Nina, that is absolutely fascinating. I can already see a few areas that I can improve on, and I'm sure people that are listening that are big health and fitness junkies are probably maybe a bit obsessive and doing their biological age, well, not doing their biological age any good. So what are the things that we can do to help reverse the biological age?
Well, the first one We learned very long. So 2016 now, we did like a nursing home study, put on a gentle exercise program and a diet, which was just improvement in diet. They did go backwards. So this is even in later age, if you implement healthy lifestyle interventions, you can reverse the clock. So let's say that in any age, you can do some. And then the second one we looked at was weight loss. And we did that both following twins, also longitudinally. So they naturally gain and lose weight. And if they gain weight, they are aging faster. If they're losing weight, they're aging slower. And then we did that in like caloric restriction diet as well. And that worked. We were going to say something.
I was just going to say, is there a direct correlation for people that are overweight and their biological clock?
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's a known correlation. If you, particularly if you have fat, high abdominal fat, that is reflecting a higher biological age. You will always find outliers. So you do every now and then get an outlier who is overweight that has a phenomenal biological age, and that could be that they are maybe healthy fat. So there is also, you know, you can have skinny fat and you can have have healthy. That. So it's not, let's say, it's very hard to put everyone in a certain box, but as a general rule, if you're overweight, that means your clock will be moving faster, and you'll be moving faster towards many chronic conditions.
Are there any other big lifestyle changes? I mean, look, you look at people, I guess, in the blue zones, the areas where there are the longest livers. Have you done any analysis on that and their age, their biological age?
We did do it. It wasn't us. It was another lab in Japan that looked at the super agers, and they had actually really high levels of these anti-inflammatory glycans, the one that you complained about earlier. Now, we don't know why. We don't know what makes those results that high, but they had phenomenally high sialic acid. It's one of those.
That's questions. A good thing to have high.
Good thing to have high. On the antibodies, it's a good thing to have high. And we're not going to, if you want to get deeper and you talk about cancer and other things, it's not a good thing to have sialic acid, but this is a different type of analysis. So what we also know works is gut health interventions. We did a few studies with microbiota transplants. You have colitis patients and they have a healthy donor microbiome.
Yes.
And you eat their whole glycogen rejuvenate. So interventions which benefit gut health are good. Now, we are doing many studies in this area, looking at both like a diverse diet of different locally sourced plants and fermented foods. These are ongoing studies, so we don't have if you follow just optimal diet for microbiome diversity, it's 30 plus different locally sourced plants. And there's a good known theory behind it, which is educating your immune system about your environment. Because if you're eating locally sourced plants that have been in local soil, they're informing your immune system about your environment. And if your immune system is informed, it creates less inflammation. It's also, for example, why you treat allergies with local honey. Same thing as food for the whole immune system. So any gut intervention should take you to a positive direction. And then estrogen. Around menopause, post-menopause has a big impact. What else do? We did exercise. So HIIT training, sprint training had a just positive effect. It was not coupled with a diet, but it had an overall positive effect. We did do gym goers, so 1,000 people going to the gym. And we saw, so I think there were, some would move, aging would even go a little bit up. But some cardio markers, so in glycans, we have one structure which is very predictive of heart attack or stroke in women. We saw that one improve. So sometimes, although exercise may create some chronic inflammation, you might be reducing some risk specific to cardio, and these risks are actually quite predictable. So they're usually quite
mine was very low on the cardio risk side of
it. There's always, you know, there's optimal balance and there's sometimes a little bit of trade-off. But let me see what else is interesting. So we have very little, a small study on supplements, one on omega-3, which had positive impact. There is one with zinc, which also changed some structures positively. Not enough to change the whole aging clock, but enough to change some of the structures positively.
So I'm recently taking NAD boosters.
So there's a brand called Nuchido. We have an upcoming publication. We did a little trial with them with a placebo control with 25 people, and we saw an effect. It was around 1 year, if I'm not wrong, or 1.2 years. So it is an effect. We're now, they only had a 1 month intervention in the study, which is very short, because it takes you about at least 2 to 3 months to change your glycan age. So it is interesting that even in that short period of time, we saw something. Now we're doing that with a 3 month trial with more people, and then we're going to see if we see larger effects. But
fantastic, because I started that just after I took your test. So it'll be really interesting to see if that has brought down or will bring down my age. And are there any other supplements? I mean, there are so many you hear for longevity, NMN, all sorts of different spermidine. There's so much I can't keep up to date with it all.
So we have, so with Nuchido, just to decouple that from NAD, like NAD plus or NMN, it's different. So they use an approach of like a whole systems approach in boosting NAD. While a lot of times you can buy the raw material like NMN and NAD plus as intravenous, we haven't done any studies on those, so we don't know if they have an effect. But it's a very different, it's a different way of boosting NAD, and I do believe in this whole systems approach, and I would really prefer it. Spermidine, we have one ongoing trial, and we're also looking at Virolitin A, which is a potential longevity supplement. All of these supplements are on the market, but they have generally evidence in animal models, so in mice. So translating something from mice to people is a steep. We don't know if it's going to work. So a lot of times, you know, it's quite experimental if you're going for it, and you know, you don't yet know if it's going to be worth the money. But a lot of people are willing to do the experiment. So this is also a way how you can measure these experiments and know if your supplement regime is actually worth doing.
And really, in terms of the future, Nina, where do you see glycan age going, or what would you like to see in, say, 5 years' time? You've mentioned a few new studies. I wrote down metabolic age study that you talked about. The menopause study, these all sound really, really interesting. When will they be available?
This is all the, you know, we have an active research lab which publishes 30 plus papers a year, and they look at many things, from reproductive age to cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and so forth. And then we wait for the science to be validated to a certain stage, and then we commercialize it. The future of it is actually preventive healthcare. So longevity is just a name, a fancy name for preventive health. So caring about your health before you encounter a problem and doing interventions before you get the disease. So what we can already do now is distinguish what disease you're heading towards. Are you heading towards cardiovascular disease, diabetes, autoimmunity, or something else? We don't do it commercially because we are working on it. To make disease claims, we have to go through certain regulatory steps. So in a couple of years' time, we'll be able to run a test. And from that, not just it will tell you your general health and your aging and areas to focus on. Right now, we tell you, you know, you have a lot of anti-inflammatory, pro-inflammatory structures, and this lifestyle intervention will impact it, or it's connected to this and that. But later on, we can tell you, hey, you're going to have hypertension in 5 years, or you're going to have insulin resistance in 5 years. And we already know that these risks can be reversed. We know that the cardio risk can be reversed with exercise. We know that the insulin resistance diabetes risk can be reversed with weight loss and caloric restriction. So these are all changeable things. It's just that we don't have this information early enough to act on it to do prevention. So we're taking these markers through regulation. And then currently, we just published a review paper 2 months ago, showing all the different diseases which are connected to what we measure in the aging clock, and we identified 72 different diseases.
Wow. And Does that include different types of cancers, or are the...
It's looking at the whole scope of your glycome. So not all of it, some of it is commercially available, some of it is not, but it goes from autoimmunity. So a big chunk of it, about 30% of it, is autoimmune associations, cardiometabolic, infectious risk, neurological dementias, cancer, colon cancer, endometrial cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, many others. So, and we have a category which is we call not disease or other, which is visceral fat, non-alcoholic fatty liver, perimenopause, smoking damage, and things like that. So those things which are not technically a disease, but will deteriorate your health. So from there, we will develop a multi-disease panel. So you can do one test that's generally looking at aging and chronic inflammation, but also gives you the disease risk in specific areas. And then you can have tailored interventions for your specific risks and follow that throughout life through the day as much as you can. And of course, a lot of it depends on you, because the first step is lifestyle. You don't have, there's very little preventive therapies, which are actually therapies that work. And I can tell you about the failed studies if you'd like. A lot of it will be down to you and the way you do it.
But I think that's what's so important, isn't it? We can actually prevent a lot of heartache and the quality of our life going downhill by what we do today in our lifestyle. And I think that's something that I certainly wanted to highlight doing this show, is that we are the CEO of our own health. Of course, there are always certain things that we can't stop. You can't stop an accident, unfortunately, from happening, but you can do everything in your power to mitigate the potential what is coming down the line. And now we have a fantastic way of measuring that, because part of it is being able to measure it. Then we can really do something about it and really take ownership, rather than looking outside but looking inside at how we can affect and change things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's having this information to have an early warning so you can work on something before it becomes a problem. And currently we check our cars more than we check our bodies. You do an annual MOT, it's mandatory. There's no such thing for your body. If you do it, you do it on your own because you cared about paying for a screening test. So hopefully healthcare changes in a way that we give this to everyone. And then when you're doing damage, even if you're really young, you know that you're doing damage. And then you make an informed decision to change or you carry on. And if you do develop a disease, you've been heading there for decades. So you know it's going on. It's not a surprise when it happened. It was your choice.
Well, this is fantastic. And if anyone does want an MOT and give this test a try, we've got a special discount code as well, which I'm going to put in the link, Sonia10. That will give you 10% off the testing kit. And I really would say it's worth it, certainly in what I've experienced so far. And I'm really excited to do it in another 6 months' time. Nina, final couple of questions. What would you like to be remembered for?
Oh, I don't know if I want to be remembered, but I guess I do. I guess I got to a point that I really love what I do, and I love the people I work with. So I hope that, I hope that one day there's a lot of people who I've kind of opened doors that would not have been there, or given information that has changed your life in some way. So they don't necessarily need to remember me, but I hope that the technology will go, or that our work will have an impact on their lives.
Well, I'm sure it will. With this is amazing what you're doing, being able to just find out how you can change the course of your life. I mean, you must be changing people's lives every single day. Is there anything important that you feel that we haven't touched on? Is there anything I've missed out that the audience should know?
I think we covered quite a bit. I think one important thing to remember is that there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all in terms of interventions. And I think the area we realize this the most is that when we did caloric restriction, that kind of works generally across the board. But for people who are overweight, if you're underweight, then probably caloric restriction is not the need. But then when these people went on certain diets, high protein, high carb, with different variations of nutrient proportion, half of the people would benefit from a certain diet, half of people would have negative effects from the exactly same diet. So you have to look for what works for you. And that's why whenever you listen to all of this general health advice, fasting, keto, this exercise regime, that drug, this drug, never take it as something that you're just going to apply to yourself and hope for the best. We need to look for these objective ways to measure if something's working for us and then adjust. And I hope that one day we can also say for sure what's going to work for an individual, but medicine, healthcare has a way to go until we get there. But I guess that's the there's no size fits all, is there?
I like that. There's no size fits all, and yeah, it should be a personalized approach. Where can people find out more about you and like an age?
So we have quite an active Instagram page where we try to simplify some of the science. We also have a podcast where we interview glycobiologists. So it's very niche, it's very much our field, but it's a field that hasn't really been explored, and not a lot of people talk about glycans. So we find all the most interesting scientists in the space, and we try to get them to simplify what they're working
Oh wow. And what's the name of that? I'll put the
on.
link in the show notes so people can take a look.
We call it Glycan Hub. It's at the bottom of our page, and you have it on Spotify and on Apple, and you can listen to some of the interviews.
Great. Oh, fantastic. And look, Nina, thank you. And as I say, we've got a discount code, Sonia10. There'll be a link in the show notes. I am looking forward to finding out my results, and I'll be chatting a little bit more about it on the podcast and finding out if the few things that I've done have actually lo lowered my biological age. So I'm very excited to find out about that. Nina, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for spending this time with me today.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for tuning into the show. Please subscribe and share. That would really help me get these valuable messages out.